Good afternoon and welcome to the Narrow Path radio broadcast. My name is Steve Gregg, and we are on live for an hour with the open phone line for you if you want to call in with questions you may have about Christianity or about the Bible or any objections you might have to them. Feel free to give me a call. The number is 844-484-5737. That number again is 844-484-5737. Now, my wife has asked me to make a request of a particular caller. We don't know his name. He called anonymously about 9 years ago. My wife, you know, she goes over these old radio shows from our archives, picking out the topics to put on Matthew7.13.com for the topical index there. And she was listening the other day to one that was like from, I guess, 2013. So that's like 9 years ago. An anonymous caller called. He's very emotional, and he was concerned about how to not hate his father. Now, it's a pretty specific kind of a call. So if she just wonders, if you are out there listening, if you are that caller, we'd love to hear a follow-up to that. So just putting that out there. And, you know, that's a long time ago. The likelihood that that caller is listening today is very small, perhaps. But if you are, feel free to give us a call, and we'll talk to you. Okay, we'd like to hear about how things went. There's a call from Beaverton, Oregon here from Eli. Welcome to the Narrow Path, Eli. What's up?
Hi, Steve. Can you hear me?
Yes, sir.
Yeah, I have a question. I wrote it down. But first of all, I would like to, you know, there was a caller a few days ago that called in, and she had a question about what Jesus said in, you know, the TV series. You said that you watch it yourself, the Chosen, and it's directed by Dallas Jenkins. And where the new series coming out, it says Jesus said, "I am the law of Moses." And there's a controversy going around that it says that is that quote is directly from the Book of Mormon. And as a former Mormon, that's not true. And I also listened to what Dallas Jenkins himself said it in some of the videos later released, that he said it, that's not in the Book of Mormon. That doesn't come from the Book of Mormon. But I think this is coming from people who doesn't really like the show. And I think the guy, well, Dallas Jenkins, first of all, is a born again evangelical Christian. He said it himself. And if the controversy is because people who are, don't like the idea of a Mormon because Angel Studio is owned by Mormons and they're distributing it. But Dallas said that he you know, that's all they're doing is distributing the show.
I hear you. Yeah. Yeah. Well, so, people call in and say all kinds of things. I told her I didn't know any of that. I didn't know about any of that. So thank you for clearing that up. You had a question of your own?
Yeah. So I have a question. So my question is, how do you respond or explain to somebody who doubt the ages of the some of the biblical characters in the Old Testament, like Methuselah, Noah, or even Adam? And that's one of my questions. And that's something I struggle with, and I hope you could clear that up for me.
Well, yeah, I mean, we only have... What?
What?
Okay. Yeah, we have the records there in Genesis 5 of the ages of these various people descended from Adam. Adam and his descendants down to Noah are recorded there. And we do read that they lived to be very old, hundreds of years old. And, you know, some people say, well, that doesn't seem very realistic. How could people live to be hundreds of years old? And I don't know how they did. All I know is those are the records. And I imagine that whoever wrote those records were as aware as we are that that's an incredibly long time for people to live and that they were recording something that's not very normal, at least normal now. It might have been more normal back then. We don't know. This is talking about the time before the flood, and it is generally believed by those of us who believe in the flood that atmospheric conditions and certain other things changed in our environment after the flood, which may have had an impact on human longevity. In fact, as you read the ages of the people in Genesis 11, I guess it is, where it talks from the people from Noah's from Noah to Abraham. The ages are considerably shorter immediately after the flood, like roughly, you know, half the length. So even though they're still long there, they still have long ages there too, but they're inexplicably, they're about half the length of the ones before the flood. So it would seem that the flood itself may have had an impact on human longevity. Why it would do so, we don't know. You know, one theory that's been floated out there, and I don't know that this has merit or that it doesn't, but some have felt that before the flood, atmospheric conditions were quite different, and that there's a canopy of water vapor surrounding the atmosphere of the Earth, which evened out and equalized the climate around the world. So it was all like tropical climate around the world. And that when the flood came, in the poetic language of Genesis, it says the windows of the heavens were opened and the waters came down. So some feel that what happened was this water canopy enveloped the atmosphere prior to the flood, and that it disappeared at the time of the flood, and that it was its presence that caused people, and perhaps animals too, to live much longer than they do now. We do know that aging is, is caused by environmental factors in some respects. I mean, every cell in your body regenerates itself, I think, within every, I think every 7 years you have all new cells. Don't quote me on the exact length of time, but it's, you're all the cells in your body replace themselves over the course of your life many times. So it would seem like you'd never get old because every cell is replaced by a new one. Why would you ever get old? Well, obviously there are forces, and some of them are radiation from the sun and from other sources in space, gamma radiation and other kinds of radiation that deteriorate the quality of the cells, so that aging takes place. The skin cells you have now, if you're an old person like me, are of lesser quality than the skin cells you had when you were a little baby, and so forth. Now, that being so, they feel that this canopy around the atmosphere of the Earth may have shielded the Earth from a lot of these rays and so forth, and it may have just simply caused people to age less quickly. And they would explain that the flood, it was a removal of that canopy. And so immediately after the flood, we see people living only about half as long. And then it trails on down till Abraham, and he's, he lives pretty old. He lives to be 175, but still pretty young compared to the people before him. And after that, the ages get lower and lower. In the time of Moses, who lived considerably more than 70 years, he wrote Psalm 90, where he said, God has given us 70 years. I guess some people get considerably more, but I can't answer what the Bible doesn't answer for us. It only records for us. And, it's not as if people who wrote the Bible were somehow unaware that people living to be 900 years old, it seems, fantastical by today's standards. It would have been fantastical by their own day's standards, too. But they didn't choose to make it, something else. And the numbers they gave were really quite exact. This person lived to be 939 years old. This person lived to 847 years old and so forth. It's not like they just rounded it off and everybody lived to be 1,000 or everyone lived to be 900 or something like that. It's possible that there were things in play before the flood that changed the way we would age, and it might have had something to do with it. I'm really grasping because I don't know. I've said right from the beginning, I don't know. But that's one explanation that has sometimes been given, and it may have some, there may be some truth in it.
I hope you don't mind.
Yeah. Go ahead.
Can I ask another quick question?
All right.
In the book of John, second chapter, when Jesus addressing his mother, when Mary asked him to turn water into wine, and she, instead of saying mother, he said woman. Is there something I'm missing there? Significance in there?
No, no. Well, maybe so. I guess if I called somebody woman, it might seem a little harsh. For example, when I was in junior high school, guys in PE called me woman. I thought that was kind of harsh. But that's different, of course. Jesus, when he spoke to people, addressed them either as man or woman. You'll find him speaking to men saying man.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, and even Paul does that. Who are you, O man, you know, to answer against God? Or O woman. He said to one woman, O woman, great is your faith. And so he was actually commending her, but he referred to her as woman. Using the word man or woman as evocative as in addressing somebody was not considered rude in those days. It is true he could have said mother, I suppose, but he was trying to communicate to her that her role as his mother, as important as mm-hmm. it was not going to be determinative of what he was going to do. In fact, she didn't specifically ask him to turn water into wine. In fact, I don't know if she even knew he could, because he had not done miracles before this. This was his first miracle. She simply came to him and said, they don't have any wine, which was a worrying thing for a host at a wedding, to run out of wine. And Jesus said, well, what is your concern to me, woman? You know, my hour's not yet come.
Mm-hmm.
Now, he wasn't trying to be rude. He's simply saying, I mean, calling her woman wasn't as rude as it sounds to us. But he's basically saying, I think the backstory, what's behind all that, is that he'd be saying something like, well, Mom, you know, I've been in your home all these years until now, and I just left home, and now I'm going about my father's business. When I was at home, you could come to me with all your problems, of course, but mm-hmm. now I'm not at your command. I'm at my father's command. So, you know, your concerns, they're not my immediate concerns, though the father apparently did later, shortly afterwards, instruct him to go ahead and turn water to wine. But I don't even know that Mary knew he could do that, because this was his first miracle. And he was 30 years old. So, you know, when you've raised a boy for 30 years, never seen him do a miracle, you don't immediately think, oh, we're out of wine. He can turn water into wine. You know, that we think that because we look back on his miracle. She had never seen it. So I don't know that she was asking specifically for him to do that. But I think the custom, since her husband Joseph had died, and that's obvious that he had by this time, that Jesus, as the oldest son in the house, probably was the man of the house that that Mary always came to with household concerns. Not that he would work miracles, but that he might shoulder that burden like the man of the house would. And so her concern here may have been shared with him just out of habit. And he's saying, now listen, I've got my own time schedule I'm on now that's not related to your concerns. You know,
mm-hmm.
and so she accepted that. She accepted that and just told the servants, if he tells you to do anything, do it. And so he did do something.
Well, thank you very much, Steve. I really appreciate your ministry. You really helped me understand the Bible clearly. Appreciate it. God bless.
Okay, Eli, thanks for your call. God bless you, too. Wayne from Dallas, Texas, welcome to The Narrow Path. Thanks for calling.
Thanks, Steve. Steve, I wanted to see if I could get you to give me your opinion on something. I have a problem, and I'm struggling with going to church. And the last church I was in, I had a problem, and I went to the pastor, and I told the pastor that I was bothered, and what I was bothered with is that we were a big church, and our weekly tithes and offerings average around $28,000, $30,000 a month. And I went to him and I talked to him. I was burdened. And I said, you know, we as a church, our focus is on a lot of things. And I said, for the last 2 years, do you know how many people that we have reached with the gospel that's come forward and given their lives to Christ? I said, 7 in the last 2 years, 7 people. And I'm bothered about that. It seems like our focus needs to be on reaching the lost, and our focus is on everything else. And we have the resources to do so much more. And I want to do more. I want to be on the front line, and I want to be a part of going in the neighborhoods and reaching the lost. I don't want to just sit here in this pew and just be entertained. And Steve, he told me,
What did he tell you?
That the devil had me. He said the devil has you. And that's why you're thinking this way.
Because you want to see the lost reached? He says the devil has you?
Yes, because I'm criticizing the church that he said, you know, we do a lot of good. And for you to say that, the devil has you. And, you know, I thought, wow, it's me. I'm wrong. And I left the church and I've not been back to church ever. And I'm stuck in.
Well, okay, let me jump in here. That was a case of spiritual abuse in a church. Now, the pastor doesn't have to agree with all your priorities. If you say, well, I think more money needs to be spent on reaching the lost, he might think, well, but our money is going to this and that and the other program, which are all also concerns of God, and we're doing what we can. I mean, he could disagree with you, but he should reason with you and say, okay, well, I appreciate your concern, and we do need to be doing that, but we also, you have to understand that the money that's come in has been gone to this or that or the other project, which, if they were good projects that really had to do with promoting the kingdom of God in some way, you know, then that'd be fine. I think, on the other hand, you caught him. I think he didn't have anything good he could answer. I think he probably was wasting the money and in some ways. And ministers who are like that don't like to be challenged. When you meet a minister who doesn't like being challenged, you're meeting a dishonest man. It's just that easy. I've had many people come up to me and say, you know, I heard my pastor say something in a sermon that didn't seem biblical to me, and I just went up and asked him to support that from the Bible, and he got angry and said, where did you go to Bible college, and so forth. And I mean, here's a man who's a dishonest man. He can't support what he's saying. And instead of saying, honestly, you know what, you may be right, I'll have to look into that. Maybe the Bible doesn't teach that, I could be wrong. But instead he just gets angry and basically abuses the person who's asking the question. That's a spiritual abuser. That there's plenty of churches that have those in leadership. Not all churches have pastors like that, but there are some, and you found one. And the problem is not yours. The devil doesn't have you, the devil has him.
So the zeal that I have is not an evil thing. It's a good thing, right?
Hey, there's nothing wrong.
To see the lost saved.
Well, right. And there's nothing wrong with criticizing a church, even if your criticism is misinformed. A church that receives criticism should be able to answer critics and without getting upset. And your pastor got upset, and he showed that he was a thin-skinned, egotistical man who was not honest and didn't want to give you a straight answer. So he just demonized you. You know, unfortunately, cult leaders do that. And sometimes people who really have the personality of cult leaders end up pastoring regular churches, too. And they're still cult leaders, but they have a church that has more of a less cult-like name on the front. But you don't have to be upset or concerned about yourself about that. That's his problem. He's got spiritual problems. I don't know if you do or not. You don't necessarily have spiritual problems because you asked that question, but you will need to find fellowship with other Christians somewhere. And unfortunately, it may not be found in the very next place or two or three that you check, because a growing number of churches in America are abandoning the work of making disciples. And some of them are just promoting a woke agenda. Some of them are just promoting the pastor's reputation. Some of them are, you know, they have their own things they want to do and make money, pay high salaries to the staff, things like that. I mean, lots of churches are doing the wrong things. And you'll find out which ones they are when you ask them about it. When you say, you know, I noticed that this church seems to do such and such. Can you tell me why? I mean, I don't see that as biblical. Can you tell me why you do that? And if a pastor is a good man and an honest man, he'll say, oh, yeah, I'll be glad to tell you. Here's, you know, there's the scripture teaches that this and this and this are the way things are done. And we're trying to follow the scriptures on that. And, your question is taken under consideration, but I think that we're going to have to follow what we think the scripture says, Although, or they could say, you know, what you've suggested really is a good balance to what we've been doing. I mean, an honest man is not going to be threatened by what your criticism is, and he's going to give you an answer. He'll be glad to answer. Anyone who's honest loves to be challenged. I'll tell you what, I mean, I love it when people call me to challenge me on the air here. Why? Not because I like to scrap. I'm not a fighter. I'm a teacher. A teacher wants to teach, wants to help get the truth across to people. And if people challenge you, that gives you an opportunity to address their concerns and to show, you know, the reasons for what you believe. That every person who speaks publicly to Christians should be prepared to do that. But even if you don't find a church that's good right away, you should still keep looking for other Christians, because you won't do well spiritually just on your own, probably. And so I would just suggest that you visit some of the churches around. I would suggest visiting the smaller churches, if there are any left in your area. Sometimes the small churches have been run out of town by the big ones. But I just say, if you can find a smallish church, it doesn't mean it's a good one. Small ones may be small because they're not good, but they may be small because they are good, and that the masses are looking for a preacher to tickle their ears and make them feel good about themselves, and not challenge them and not to preach the Bible. And so churches, you know, that have bad preaching of that sort often get very large. And the good preachers sometimes don't have a very big congregation. Though I wouldn't just say that a small church is a better church because it's small. There may be other reasons for it being small. The point is, though, that you're going to probably have better fortune looking for, humble pastors among smaller churches. And what you want is not even so much what the pastor is like, although that's important, but what the people are like, if there's a community there. Church is supposed to give you a sense of family, of community, with people who want to serve God in a corrupt world like you do. So, however, we should realize, too, that seeing people get saved isn't the only mark of the quality of a church, because the pastor may spend most of his time discipling the flock, and assuming that most of the evangelism will take place outside the church, which is how it was in the early days of the church in the book of Acts. When the Christians got together, they didn't get together to be evangelized. They already had been evangelized. They were Christians. But they got together to be taught. They sat daily under the apostles' teaching, and they wanted to be taught how to observe everything Jesus commanded. That's what the disciples are supposed to be taught, to observe all things that Jesus commanded. So a pastor who does that might have primarily a Christian congregation, and he may be ministering to their needs as Christians rather than crafting his sermons toward evangelism of unbelievers who aren't maybe there very often. But if unbelievers aren't there very often, that's not saying the church is bad. But I think that the people in the church, if they're healthy Christians, are going to be going out evangelizing their neighbors and bringing new converts to church. And the church, I think the church does a good job if it disciples them. But the church you just described, I don't think was doing that. Doesn't sound like it. Not with that kind of a pastor. Anyway, I'm sorry that you had that happen to you, but it's not you that was wrong. But it would be wrong for you to stop fellowshipping, for you to give up on Christian assemblies. It may be that you'll find fellowship in a small group like a home church. There are them around, and they are quite legitimate. Or maybe a smallish church, regular steeple house kind of church. But don't give up on the Christian church. Realize that there's a lot of people in organizations called churches who probably aren't really born again, and that means the church is going to probably hire a pastor who himself may or may not be born again, but he's not going to be doing what he should be doing. He'll be doing what the unbelievers in his church are paying him to do. So look for honest and humble leadership and loving congregations. And you can find that in a church that has 12 people or 120 or maybe 500 people. But as they get real big, you start losing out on some of the community dynamics. Anyway, I'm sorry to hear about your experience. It's not rare. Actually, unfortunately, pastors like that are fairly common. And I hear stories like that far too often. Thank you for calling. We're going to have to take a break here, and then we'll have another half hour coming up, so don't go away. Our lines are full with people who want to get on the air in the next half hour, and I will try to get all of them on. You're listening to The Narrow Path radio broadcast. My name is Steve Gregg, and we are listener-supported. If you'd like to help us pay the radio bills to keep us on the air, you can write to us at The Narrow Path, P.O. Box 1730, Temecula, California, 92593. That's The Narrow Path, P.O. Box 1730, Temecula, California, 92593. You can also donate if you wish from our website. Everything at the website is free, but there's thousands of resources there. We just don't sell anything in this ministry at all. The website is thenarrowpath.com. It is possible to donate there, but it's also possible to just take what you want and don't donate at all. It's at thenarrowpath.com. If you're thinking about what to get your pastor for Christmas, think about getting my book, Empire of the Risen Sun, books 1 and 2. I think your pastor will benefit from it, and you might check it out under my name, Steve Gregg, at Amazon. I'll be back in 30 seconds. Stay tuned.
Small is the gate and narrow is the path that leads to life. Welcome to The Narrow Path with Steve Gregg. Steve has nothing to sell you today, but everything to give you. When the radio show is over, go to thenarrowpath.com where you can study, learn, and enjoy with free topical audio teachings, blog articles, verse-by-verse teachings, and archives of all The Narrow Path radio shows. We thank you for supporting the listener-supported Narrow Path with Steve Gregg. See you at thenarrowpath.com.
Welcome back to the Narrow Path radio broadcast. My name is Steve Gregg, and we are live for another half hour taking your calls. If you have questions about the Bible or the Christian faith, feel free to give me a call. Before the break, I said our lines were full, and they were, but one line has opened up during the break, so you might want this number. The number is 844-484-5737. That's 844-484-5737. Our next caller is Rez, calling from the Bay Area, California. Hi, Rez. Welcome.
Hey, Steve. Thanks for taking my call. Yeah, the last caller reminded me of myself, and the SDA would tell me I'm of the devil because I don't believe what they say. And, you know, I think of Mike Tyson when he said, the more I look into churches for God, the more I find the devil.
Hey, you know what? You're echoing quite a bit. Are you on a speakerphone?
No.
That's strange.
Can you hear me now?
Yeah, better. I'm just being up close. Yeah, probably helps to be up close to
it.
Yeah, there's a big echo. Go ahead.
Sorry about that.
What's your question?
So my question was regarding why is Gnosticism such a heresy? I've heard them say something about like there's a demiurge God that's not the top God that created this universe. Mm-hmm. And that, you know, they have some interesting beliefs. They talk about Sophia, a God that created this God. And I just wondered, why is Gnosticism such a heresy? How do we know it's a heresy? And what do you know about it and think about it?
Well, just the few things you listed would be one reason why it's a heresy. But the Gnostic view was that the high God, who's the father of Jesus Christ, is not the same God who created the heavens and the earth. They believe that pure spirit is good, but anything material, anything physical, is evil. Physical bodies, the physical planet, physical stars, anything physical is evil. And anything spiritual is good. So they'd say the high God, the highest God, who is the father of Jesus, is, of course, pure spirit, which I have no problem with that. But they would say he could never have contact with physicality because physicality is evil. Therefore, he would never have created a physical world. What they say is the world was created by, as you said, the demiurge. The demiurge is what we might call the devil. But they would say that's the God of the Old Testament. When they read about God in the Old Testament, they think that's the devil. Jesus said that the God of the Old Testament is the same God that he called his Father. So, I mean, they've got a serious problem right there. If they're calling God the Father the devil, I don't know how to be more blasphemous than that. But what they believe is that from the true God, the highest God, he sent out emanations, like if you throw a rock into a pool and the rings, you know, that emanate from where the rock went in and go further and further out. They would say these emanations are beings themselves. And so there's this whole hierarchy of beings from the highest God down to the demiurge, and that they're at varying degrees of proximity or distance from the true God. And it took quite a few of these to get far enough from the true God to be able to make a physical universe. Because, as I say, whoever made the physical universe is bad. And so the true God, who's the Father of Jesus, would have to be separated from that by some distance. And so the demiurge is like the devil, who's bad enough to create evil and who masqueraded as God in dealing with the Israelites. Now, that was a heresy that actually appeared in Judaism as well as Christianity. There were Jewish Gnostics and Christian Gnostics, but the Christian Gnostics should not be called Christian. They arose within the Christian church, just like many cults and heresies arise in the church throughout history. It was one of the earliest heresies. The earliest heresy, the church had to deal with Judaizers who were trying to put Christians under the Jewish law. But the next earliest heresy was Gnosticism, and this really didn't develop until the second century, but it had some of its beginnings, some of its ideas began and were found in Greek philosophy in the first century. And you can tell that 1 John, for example, the first epistle of John, is written to refute some of these ideas that later were incorporated into Gnosticism. But without going into all kinds of detail about what Gnosticism teaches, the main idea is that, you know, the true God is not the God who created everything. And therefore, you know, the Father of Jesus is not the same God that we read about in the Old Testament, which is the opposite of what Jesus said. Also, because the Gnostics believe that matter is evil and that Jesus was divine, they believe he could not have really been a physical person. He couldn't become part of the material universe, which is evil. So they argued one of two things. There was a teacher named Cerinthus who taught that the Christ essence came on the man. Jesus was an ordinary man, but the Christ essence came on him at his baptism and left him shortly before his death on the cross. So that the man Jesus is not really identified with the Christ, which of course disagrees with everything the Scripture says, including what the angels said when Jesus was born: "Unto you is born this day a Savior, who is Christ, the Lord." You know, so I mean, Jesus is the Christ. The Christ was not a thing that came on him at his baptism. He was born the Christ. The other Gnostic view that was not taught by Cerinthus was called Docetism. And it comes from a word that means to seem. And the Docetic heresy was that Jesus only seemed to be physical. He wasn't really a physical man at all. He's really a phantom. They said that when he walked, he didn't leave footprints because he really only appeared to be physical. Now, these were Gnostic heretical views. They're different variations on Gnosticism that were denying that Jesus really was God in the flesh. They would either deny that he was God but never really became flesh, or that he was flesh and the deity kind of came on him and left him at his death. These are, of course, absurdly heretical ideas vis-a-vis what the Bible teaches. So, you know, if someone says, well, why is Gnosticism so bad? Well, because it's about as far from being Christian as any heresy can possibly be. That's why it's called a heresy. Okay, let's talk to Jeff from Los Angeles, California. Jeff, welcome to the Narrow Path.
Hi, Steve.
Hi.
My question is about the Seventh-day Adventist. Would you consider it a cult, or is it mainline?
Well, it's not mainline, but a group doesn't have to be mainline to be Christian. Mainline denominations are just denominations, after all. The Seventh-day Adventists hold views about salvation, for the most part, that are evangelical and therefore would probably be regarded in the fold by many. They do have aspects of them that are cultic. And when I say that, I realize that when we use the word cult, Christians who use the word cult usually mean non-Christian. Like if we call the Mormons a cult or Jehovah's Witness a cult, essentially that's another way of saying they're not really Christian. They're kind of fake Christians. Right. But when I use the word cultic, by the way, the Bible doesn't use the word cult at all. But when I use the word cultic, I'm thinking more in terms of the sociological aspects of a religious group that's tyrannized or governed by a totalitarian kind of organization or person. That earlier caller who was talking about the pastor who didn't want to be challenged, I would consider him a cult leader, even though he might be, I don't know what church, he might be pastoring a mainline denominational church, but he's a cultic man. And I believe that Seventh-day Adventism can be cultic. It has its own prophetess, Ellen G. White, who's pretty much the founder of it. And some Seventh-day Adventists definitely have a cult-like loyalty to her. And some apparently don't. I have known some Seventh-day Adventists who say, no, we don't consider her to be inspired or a prophet. We just think she had some good things to say. Well, actually, she did have some good things to say. Most people do. She had some things to say that are misleading as well. But the main things that the group teaches that's contrary to Christianity is that that we're saved by keeping the Ten Commandments, or not saved by it, but once we are saved, we have to keep the Ten Commandments, including the Sabbath commandment. And that since the Sabbath is on Saturday, in the Bible, we should be worshiping on Saturday. They go so far in their literature of saying that worshiping on Sunday is offensive to God. In fact, their actual belief is that the Antichrist is going to come and mandate that everybody worship on Sunday instead of Saturday. And they will say when that happens, then worshiping on Sunday will actually be the mark of the beast. Now, that's weird stuff, obviously. That's weird, unscriptural doctrine. It technically does actually present a different method of salvation. I was debating a Seventh-day Adventist not very long ago, and, it was claimed that they don't teach it, you have to keep the Sabbath to be saved. But I did point out that they do believe that when the Antichrist comes and makes the National Sunday Law, as they call it, then you will have to worship on Saturday to be saved. Because they believe if you worship on Sunday then, that you'll be taking the mark of the beast, which means you won't be saved. So they do have cult-like teachings and sometimes a cult-like attitude toward their leader. I would say of the Seventh-day Adventists I've known, most of them seem to have a cult-like adherence to Ellen G. White. Some of them, maybe not so much. So, the question of whether they're Christian, I believe that their doctrines allow them to be Christian. I don't think there's anything that they believe that a Christian cannot hold to, though I believe they have several doctrines that are wrong. Christians can be wrong about a number of things and still be Christians, but why be wrong if you don't have to? As far as I'm concerned, it's a church that has some wrong teachings, and that's partly because of the influence of their prophetess who founded the movement.
Right, thank you. And then as far as you mentioned the Antichrist, I was reading 2 Thessalonians, and do you believe the Antichrist will be an individual, or is it like a group, a head of a movement? He'll have to have followers. Am I wrong?
Well, the Bible uses the word Antichrist only one way, and it does not refer to Antichrist as an individual. Now, there are other words that are used which might be applied to individuals. You were reading 2 Thessalonians 2. There's reference to the man of lawlessness. In Revelation 13, yeah, there's something called the beast. Some people think that's a man. I don't think either of those are necessarily an individual man, but neither of them are referred to as the Antichrist. Now, the word Antichrist is used only in 1 John, the epistle, 1st epistle of John, and the 2nd epistle of John. Now, the second epistle of John uses the word exactly the way it's used in 1 John. But in 1 John, chapter 2, verse 18, says, "Little children, it is the last hour, and as you have heard that the Antichrist is coming, even now many Antichrists have come, by which we know that it is the last hour." And then he says this in verse 21, verse 22, "Who is a liar but he who denies that Jesus is the Christ? He is Antichrist who denies the Father and the Son." So whoever denies that Jesus is the Christ is Antichrist. And then in John, 1 John 4, it talks about those who deny that Jesus Christ is come in the flesh, that these also are the spirit, have the spirit of Antichrist. In 1 John 4, 3, he says, "Which you have heard was coming, and now already is in the world." Now, the Antichrist that they had heard was coming, John said was already in the world when he was writing 2,000 years ago. So we can hardly imagine that he's referring to a man who will be around, 2,000 years later in our time. The Antichrist, he said there's many Antichrists, not just one. Anyone who denies that Jesus Christ is Antichrist, he said. And he said, "You heard he was coming." Well, it's already, he called it it. He said, "It's already in the world." So it's the spirit of Antichrist he's talking about. So, you couldn't really use the Bible to argue for a man called Antichrist. I realize it's a very popular teaching, and it has been. Actually, church fathers even use the term Antichrist, I think, to refer to a man. But the Bible doesn't use it that way. So, I guess we can decide whether to go with what the traditions have said or go with what the Bible says. I appreciate your call, but we need to move along. We've got people waiting and little time. Joe from Clovis, California. Welcome to The Narrow Path. Thanks for calling.
Oh, hey, thanks for taking my call, Steve. Appreciate it.
Uh-huh.
Listen to your program all the time. So I'm in a study right now in Hebrews with my church, and it made me start to think as we were reading about the Levitical system. So under that Mosaic covenant, people had a way, to be saved. So I was just wondering, like before the flood, how were people saved before the flood?
Well, I think Hebrews 11 answers that for us. It goes through all the people from Abel onward. Abel was, of course, the son of Adam and Eve. And then Enoch is mentioned in Hebrews 11, 5. Enoch is then mentioned, and then Noah in verse 7, and then Abraham. All these are before Moses and the law were given. Isaac and Jacob are mentioned, and then eventually Moses is mentioned. Now, so what he says, all these people they received a good report from God by faith. They were saved by faith. We know Abraham in particular. It says of him in Genesis 15:6, Abraham believed in the Lord, and it was counted to him for righteousness. So Abraham was a long time before the law, 400 years before the law, and or more, possibly. So, justification has always been by faith. Abel was justified by faith. Enoch was justified by faith. Noah was by faith. Abraham was by faith, and all the rest.
Can I ask, how did they know, what to have faith in, though? Under the Levitical system, they had, priests that would tell you the law and everything,
Yeah, before they had the law, they just had God, When God spoke to them, they believed him. And, they believed what God said. That's what it says. God, Abraham believed the Lord, and it was counted to him for righteousness. So, God didn't, even under the law, they didn't have a very full understanding of the gospel as we know it. There are intimations of it, and there were types and shadows of it in the sacrifices, but it wasn't really clearly known. But, people responded to the light God had given them, and their faith justified them in God's sight. So, I assume that's
a quick follow-up question about that.
Okay.
So in 1 Peter chapter 3, I think it's verse 19, where it says that he went and he preached. Who was he preaching to?
Well, that's not a small question. That requires the consideration of several different options. I believe that that verse is referring to the Spirit of Christ preaching through Noah to the unbelievers of his day. It says specifically they were disobedient in the days of Noah while the ark was being prepared. So that's the audience, the people who were disobedient. Now, he does refer to them as the spirits in prison, which no doubt refers to them being in Sheol or in Hades. But, of course, that's where they were at the time Peter was writing. These people who died in the flood, to whom Noah had preached, they were now in Hades. So he could refer to them as the spirits that are in Hades, who were disobedient in the days of Noah. Now, it says that it was through the Spirit Jesus preached to them. Now, the Old Testament prophets and Noah himself preached through the Spirit of Christ. So what Peter is saying is it was through the Spirit of Christ that Noah preached to those in his day. And thus Jesus, through his Spirit, was preaching to them. And so that would be what I understand that to mean. Other people think this has to do with Jesus going down to Hades and preaching down there. That is one theory that is widely held, but doesn't really fit the particular details of the passage. So I think it's got a different referent. All right, let's talk to Norma from Pittsburgh, Pennsylvania. Hi.
Good evening. Good evening, Mrs. Steve. Thank you for sharing your wisdom with us. I have a brief question because I've been having a dispute with someone who indicated that after Jesus went to heaven, it was the first person went up after Jesus was Enoch. And I said it was one of the thieves that hung on the cross with him. Who is right?
Well, we're not told who the first one is. Enoch had gone up to heaven before. I mean, Enoch went to heaven before the flood of Noah's day. He was seven generations from Adam and three generations before the flood. So, yeah, Enoch went up there before Jesus did even. As far as the thief on the cross, we have to assume that the thief on the cross went the same time Jesus did. But there may have been many others, too. Some people believe that all the people who we were just talking about to our last caller, all the Old Testament people who died in faith and were justified by faith, were kept, you know, in holding, as it were, in Hades, waiting for Jesus to come. And when he died and rose again and ascended to heaven, they went with him. And there is a reference that may refer to that in Ephesians 4, where it says, when he ascended on high, he led a host of captives. And some people believe that the host of captives is a reference to the souls of righteous people who died in faith in the Old Testament, who had been kept in Hades and were now went to heaven with Jesus. That would include the thief on the cross, though, but he would have been like the last guy to get in on that group.
Okay. It is greatly appreciated, and blessings to you, your family, and your audience. Thank you so very kindly.
Thank you very much for your call. It's a pleasure to talk to you. Robert from Downey, California. Welcome to The Narrow Path.
Yeah, hey, this is Robert. Let me get you off speaker. Okay, yeah, this is Robert. Hey, going through, I definitely believe the Bible obviously is the Word of God, but I do know there's certain passages and things that are, whether it be poetry or whether it be just historic or whatever, I'm confused as I go through Leviticus, for example, and you got all these rules, obviously things, obviously talking to the, the Israelites coming out of, you know, Egypt and all that. How do we know when we read it, what applies to us? What was for them? How do we distinguish? And when we quote verses, we often quote verses that are, common. I don't have my Bible with me right now. I'm driving, but there's so many verses that are just common that we quote. Are they to us? Do they apply to us? Do they apply just to Israelites? That's my question. Does that make sense?
Sure.
Okay.
Yeah. Okay.
Thanks.
First of all, yeah, the law of Moses had 613 commands. Not all of them are in Leviticus, but a lot of them are. Some of them are in Exodus, some are in Deuteronomy, and a few of them are in Numbers. But there are 613 commands. Now, which of those apply to us and which don't? Well, none of them apply to us directly from the law. But we have to realize that some of the things that God commanded Israel in the law were general rules for all humanity, like you should not murder, you should not commit adultery, you should not steal. These are not laws that God made up to give to Israel. These were wrong back in the day when Cain killed Abel. He did something. Murder was wrong then too. Adultery was always wrong in the in ancient times. And virtually every society was under that code. And yet some of those moral standards, they are universal, and they're still universal to this day. But some of them were incorporated into the law of Moses just so, to make sure that they knew that God, you know, stood behind these. And anything that's a moral standard, it was not distinctly for Israel, because morality is the same for everybody. Now, Israel had a bunch of laws given that weren't for everybody. Circumcision, Sabbath keeping, going to the tabernacle, offering sacrifices a certain way, abstaining from certain foods as unclean, making pilgrimages three times a year, observing certain holy days. These are laws that only applied to Israel, and you can tell the difference between them and the moral laws, because the moral laws are laws about being good and about not hurting people and not wronging people. They are laws about justice and mercy and faithfulness. These are what Jesus called the weightier matters of the law. And you could actually ask yourself if a law is moral or not, and answer it for yourself by saying, could God have given this law differently without compromising his own character? You know, in other words, could God command people the opposite of this without compromising his character? Well, if the answer is no, he couldn't. He couldn't tell people to commit adultery or to steal. That would compromise God's own character. Well, then those are moral commands. Those are universal. Those are for everybody. They were true before the law was given. They were true when the law was given, and they're true after the law is taken away. They're just a standard of righteousness that God requires of all people, and all people will be judged by it. But if you ask, you know, well, could God have given the Sabbath commandment differently, or the requirement to make three pilgrimages to the temple per year differently? Of course, he could have given that. That wouldn't compromise his character. He could have said, keep 2 days holy, not just the seventh day, but how about the seventh and the third? You know, I mean, that wouldn't compromise his character to do things differently, because those are rituals. Whatever is not intrinsically tied to God's moral nature are just religious rituals. And it should be obvious, I mean, that, you know, offering a lamb isn't some kind of eternal moral requirement. God could have said, offer chipmunks, and it would not have been a compromise of his character to give a command like that. But if he said, offer your children, that would be a compromise in his character, because that'd be murder. So, I mean, Christians should do a little thinking, but what makes it easy is to say, what did Jesus say to do? Because Jesus, what he told his disciples to do would encompass all the moral issues. When he said, love God with all your heart, soul, mind, and strength, and love your neighbor as you love yourself. Paul said, love does no harm to his neighbor. So love is the fulfilling of, you know, the law that's required for us. Jesus tells us to love. And could you love somebody and not make a pilgrimage to Jerusalem? Of course. Could you love somebody and sleep with their wife? No, you couldn't. So, I mean, basically Jesus' teaching affirmed the morality, the universal morality that was true even before the law was given, and was true in the law, and is true now. But the rituals, those were part of the old covenant. They're not part of the new covenant. So that's not for us to be required to do. All right, you've been listening to the Narrow Path radio broadcast. My name is Steve Gregg, and we are listener supported. Our address is The Narrow Path, P.O. Box 1730, Temecula, California, 92593. You can also donate from our website, although we'd love to have you take everything from the website for free. It's thenarrowpath.com. Thanks for joining us. Let's talk again tomorrow.